Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to this episode of the Elevated Places Network presents A Time for Justice. This show discusses legal and current events in a roundtable discussion of legal minds. We will discuss this country's centuries-long failure to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws, and the overall failures of the legal system to give justice, and the negative impacts these failures have had on Black people and their Black families. Ultimately, we want fair dealing, we want justice under the law, but all too often, this is not the actions that we see. I am your host, Sister Pamela Muhammad, and I am an attorney, and our guest tonight will not make those excuses for conduct, legal conduct, oftentimes in the courts, that really is distracting from the truth and the law. And so we want the truth told, and because we know that the truth is the path to justice and equal protection. So let's talk about just, fair, and equitable solutions, which are in the best interest of the people. Again, I am your host, Sister Pamela Muhammad, and I want to say assalamu alaikum. And so tonight, we have a really great show, you know, by Allah's permission. We are bringing two attorneys, and I'm just so very excited. Tonight, our show is entitled First Amendment Protections and Federal Law. So let me go ahead and bring in our lawyers. I want to open up their mics. The first attorney I'm going to bring on is our brother, Brother Joseph Mockendahl. Brother Mockendahl has been on our show before. He is an attorney. He's a member of the nation. He is actually serves as a representative in New York, as a student representative in the mosque. But he also is an attorney. And his background is that of being the past president of the Haitian American Lawyers. Brother Joseph was also in politics, being a former mayor. Brother Joseph, that's right, he was the first black mayor to Ocean County, which is in New Jersey. This was in 2010. And so this is something that is really, you know, just a huge accomplishment to me for our brother, because he was the first NOI official elected mayor in the history of the NOI, Brother Joseph says, and he is committed and passionate about serving his constituency and the people. And so that was part of his history, as well as the fact that he practices law in New Jersey, focusing primarily on immigration, criminal law, personal injury, business, and family law. And going on, Brother Joseph has served in just many different capacities on advisory committees. He's actually, you know, just a founding member of a executive board officer of the National Haitian American Elected Officials Network. And so I'm going to go ahead and open up Brother Joseph's mic and introduce him to some, but many of us, you know, we know him. He is our brother. Brother Joseph.
Assalamu alaikum, dear sister. Thank you so much once again for having allowed me to come on this platform, the Elevated Place. It's always an honor, a privilege to share same platform with you and of course, your guests. So to you and to all your guests, I say assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, and the pleasure is mine, Brother Joseph. All praises are due to Allah, because as you say, you know, this show is a time for justice, and it's a legal show, and we are on the Elevated Places Network, so we're very excited. Now, we have a special guest as well, and Brother Joseph brought this attorney to our attention. Brother Joseph is he knows this attorney and had, you know, suggested that this would be an excellent opportunity for us to hear from some of the people that are on the front line. So I want to thank you, Brother Joseph, for making this contact for us. But let me go ahead and introduce Kevin Berry. Attorney Kevin Berry is a New York. He's in New York, and he practices with the Mayor Magist Law Group. The firm was featured in the New Yorker magazine as the anti-shutdown lawyers because they sued New York Governor Cuomo and New York City Mayor de Blasio 16 times to open up New York. And so those cases led to openings of multiple businesses segments and the loosening of some of the restrictions during the COVID era. Mr. Attorney Berry, he goes on to talk about how he consults with students and employees of all faiths nationwide on religious exemptions to allow them to continue their education and keep their job. In 2014, Attorney Berry, anticipating the attack on religious freedom, Attorney Berry founded First Freedoms, Inc., which is an organization dedicated to advancing the five freedoms guaranteed by the First Amendment. And he goes on to say those are freedom of religion, speech, the press, petition, government. And also just kind of wanted to put out there that Attorney Berry is also a former lawyer in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York, and he is the author of Vaccine Whistleblower, Exposing Autism Research Fraud at the CDC. And he states in his bio that this book, which first released the transcripts of CDC's Dr. William Thompson's conversations with Dr. Brian Hooker to the public. So this attorney by the name of Kevin Berry, let me go ahead and open up his mic. I believe this is Mr. Berry. Yes,
it is. Thank you for having me. I'm here, yes. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. Thank you so much, and welcome to A Time for Justice. Again, I'm an attorney along with Brother Joseph. I know you're familiar with Brother Joseph, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, sir.
Wonderful man.
And so, yeah, beautiful, beautiful. And thank you for all that you've been doing. It's so exciting. So we want to go ahead and just open up the conversation. Again, the topic is First Amendment protections and federal law. And so really, as you stated in your bio, but I wanted to reiterate, First Amendment, we're talking about the constitutional amendment which guarantees freedoms, religion, concerning religion, freedom of expression, right to petition, and specifically we're talking about the rights that religious freedom gives us and how your religion cannot be restricted. Your practices. And so, you know, we want to go into some of that as well as we're talking about federal protections as well. And I think when it comes to employment, employee situations and some of these exemptions or some of this mandate, we're looking at Title VII and, you know, the federal law. And I want to go ahead and open up this conversation as we have all heard probably that Biden's mandates regarding the contractors, I believe, the federal contractors that another court down in Georgia, the U.S. District Court in the Southern District of Georgia, has instituted a injunction to prevent those workers from being terminated because of their refusal to get this shot. So, you know, this is a hot topic, and I would really like for you both to just weigh in and tell us a little bit about what you busy attorneys have been doing regarding this issue.
Go ahead, Joseph. Do you want to start?
No. I just wanted to give a quick background. I met with attorney Kevin Berry on the battlefield, so to speak. We were militating against the introduction of a bill that's in the state of New Jersey that sought to, you know, do away with the parents' religious rights. And lo and behold, he was present along with some other doctors who have become friends of mine, and Brother Reza Islam was present as well, and we engaged in activisms, and we had planned our activities around the state, and we had our first meeting, one of our first meetings rather, was at my office, my law office in Toms River, where we got to know each other and pretty much connected on that issue. And I have been very grateful to have had a chance to meet with Mr. Berry, particularly knowing that he has been at the forefront of this particular topic. And in fact, he, as you indicated, he wrote the book on vaccine whistleblower exposing autism research fraud at the CDC. He also works with Robert Kennedy as well in that respect. And so I remain grateful to have made that connection, and I you know, find myself being part of their circle as I was a keynote, one of the speakers rather, in two of their events on religious freedom. They just recently had a third one, which I couldn't attend due to scheduling conflict. But nevertheless, I just wanted to give this quick background before we delve into the issue at hand. Thank you.
Oh, excellent. Thank you, Brother Joseph. Yes, sir. Attorney Berry.
And I'd love to add one other piece of that from what I think is somewhat amusing story, and but because of Joseph's status as a former mayor, he was able to go to a breakfast that was only for like mayors and former mayors, which was featuring the New Jersey Senate President Steve Sweeney, the one who just lost his election to a truck driver who spent $150 on his entire campaign, but Senate President Sweeney was seeking to take away the religious rights of 9 million citizens in New Jersey. And Joseph, as a former mayor, had an ability to go to this breakfast by himself and bring three guests. So he brought me and two doctors, Liam Schubel and Stu Warner, and then we got to sit right at the front seat at the podium where he was talking nonsense about not needing the religious exemption. He was just trying to take away the religious exemption. And at these meetings, there's never anyone giving pushback to what the person is saying. And there's never any genuine dialogue or someone questioning. And as soon as Senate President Sweeney opened the floor for questioning, the first hand up was Mayor Joseph. And then we were off to the races. It was a great moment.
Great story.
Beautiful story. Thank you. Because as you said, we can go into the censorship issue because that's one of the biggest restraints we're seeing right now, as well as, you know, the right to our body and autonomy and all the rest of it. But with the censorship, Attorney Berry, have you ever seen this level of censorship in the law where, you know, or do you think we're seeing censorship?
Oh, we are certainly seeing censorship. And I think I've never seen it on this level, but one thing that where it gets a little bit murky is all of these things like Facebook, like YouTube, which is owned by Google, like Twitter. Those are private companies also. They're like quasi governmental. They seem to be governmental, but they're not. So they have free speech rights also. So that's one of the reasons it's difficult to nail down those companies on censorship, because they will assert their own free speech rights, which is it gets a little complicated. But that's an unfortunate situation. It's unfortunate in the same way that the Citizens United case really hurt campaign finance and opened up the ability for corporations to have too much influence in politics. The idea of those cases was that these large conglomerates and political action committees also had free speech rights as individual people do, and that's the way they get around using their financial resources to have overly important voice in politics.
Right. Wow. And like you say, they're quasi, so they're using government funds, but at the same time, and you tell me, I mean, I think that is what we're seeing, some ability to compete on a much higher level as a private corporation, so, but they're still enjoying all the rights of a private private person,
I think,
right?
I think that's right. But one of the bigger problems is they're desperate that to not be regulated. They don't want the federal government regulating them. So if they're restricting speech that the federal government doesn't like, that they're doing it perhaps so they won't be regulated.
Interesting. Okay. And the thing is, Brother Joseph, he is actually serving as a co-questioner, quote, you know, this is a roundtable discussion, so Brother Joseph, feel free to just jump in. And so when we talk about these mandates, and we've never seen anything like this, and so you mentioned in your bio that your company or that you participated in, you know, actually fighting to kind of temper that, to stop those with these shutdowns cases that the New York Magazine attributed to your firm. Can you share with us any lessons, any commentary on that activity? Go ahead.
Yeah, I would say one of the lessons that we saw is that any time the state of New York or the city had to show up in court with evidence to justify the restrictive policies they had, the day before that court hearing where their evidence would be challenged, they would open the restaurants or open the gym or open the pool hall, because they were, I think, a combination of insecure about whether they had the evidence to justify the policy, or they straight up knew that they did not have the evidence. So I think that, but that all fits into this.
Are you still there? Brother Joseph, are you there, Brother Joseph?
We lost him.
Okay. So, no, that was real good information.
Yeah, real good information. But for the purpose of your listeners, it is I know you mentioned First Amendment, and he was expounding on Facebook and Twitter, those social media outlets who present themselves as being private, and yet they, in some instances, are receiving public funds. So, in essence, that makes them quasi, public state actors. In some instances, and so if they are quasi-state actors, then they should abide by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and the Constitution in general as well. And it becomes important to explain, you know, or to really give a clear definition of what the First Amendment to the United States Constitution is all about. For the purpose of being very clear, it states that the First Amendment to prevent the government from making laws which regulate an establishment of religion, or that it would prohibit the free exercise of religion, or abridge the freedom of speech, the freedom of the press, the freedom of assembly, or the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. So we're talking about, whenever we talk about freedom of speech, where an individual is expressing their opinion on a particular topic, and it has sufficient evidence to support it, you know, which makes it pass even an opinion, you know, it can be considered as a scientific statement, then we'll find that those social media platforms are censoring those opinions or those scientific expressions only because it goes contrary to the modus operandi of the government and all the pharmaceutical companies. So that's the I wanted to bring out so that I can get some clarity in that. I don't know if
Attorney Barry is back, and so I think Attorney Kevin Barry, are you back on the line?
Yes, I'm sorry the call dropped, but I'm back.
Yeah, no, thank you. And so you were also telling us about some of the lessons you learned with the litigation and how right before hearing, potentially they were concerned about whether they had the evidence to justify certain policies. That was the thought. So could you want to continue with that?
Yeah, so I'll just tell one quick story. We were one of the few cases that actually went to a hearing. It was to open pool halls, and because restaurants had already been opened, but pool halls were still closed. And the state of New York, the Attorney General's office, was arguing that the felt of a pool table was a hiding place for COVID. And I wish I was lying about that. But that was like how weak their evidence was, and the judge was asking the poor fellow who was trying to represent the state's position, but how is like the pool table different than a seat with upholstery at an airport? And they don't have no answer for that. They call a recess, and the next thing is the state decides to drop the case, and they reopen the pool halls. So that I think that is a model we're going to see time and time again over as these cases get in front of judges and their evidence has to be tested, that they don't have the evidence to support what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I think if you want to go into a little bit of conspiracy land, I think every time, well, not every single time, but every time they get close to being exposed for how fraudulent this is, there's going to be a new variant.
Okay. Interesting.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Because
they're saying now the current variant is even more lethal than the previous one. So it's almost like a episodes after episodes, they're coming with new variants. Not saying that it does not exist or not. This is not the point. But the point is how interesting how they would qualify each new variant as being so lethal, and yet supposedly there are vaccines who are there to curtail the COVID virus altogether.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Whatever this new one is, whatever this Omicron or however they're pronouncing the new one.
Right.
Like that one popped up very suspiciously as federal judges were blocking Biden's mandate. So it's like, yeah. Federal judges are starting to step in to block this overreach of government power. We better ramp up the fear mechanism.
Right. Yeah. Mm. And as you say, with doctors, you know, there are credible doctors who are being censored who say that the vaccine does not, you know, prevent COVID. The people who are vaccinated still get it. You know, people are dying, the safety and efficacy and all of that being challenged. So we know that there's a whole really substantive issue regarding the practice. And many people who are on the front line are fighting just that issue, that these, you know, these shots are not safe or are effective or needed even. So, but, you know, as we talk about the litigation and the timing, I'm hearing what you're saying. It's like a strategy to distract, and that's one of the issues that we talk about on this program is the distractions that happen with law sometimes to circumvent the truth. So I appreciate you bringing that up. So go ahead, sir.
I think that's exactly right what you just said, but it fits into this concept of the emergency, like the mm-hmm. most of the things that they're trying to do. In ordinary times, there is no way a court would allow it to happen. But if there's a pandemic emergency, that's how governors are getting extraordinary powers. That's how this mandate he's trying to do it from the White House. This has never happened before in the history of the United States. They've never had anything like this happen. So why are they even trying it, or why do they think they can get away with it? Because of the emergency. And usually, like over the course of the United States, some of the worst Supreme Court cases you're going to see are when governments tried to use emergency. Like during the Civil War, they suspended habeas corpus and were putting people in jail without charges because of the emergency of the Civil War. As soon as the war was over, they stopped that and said that we can't do that. During World War II, Supreme Court allowed for Japanese internment camps on the West Coast in a 1944 case because of the emergency. They locked up American citizens, you know, in internment camps because of the emergency. So I think 100 years from now, when people are reading the history of this time, the question will be, how did they get away with convincing people this was an emergency for 2 years, 3 years, or however long they're going to continue trying to do it? Because whatever emergency there might have been at the beginning of this, when no one was sure what we had, you know, you can give them the benefit of the doubt for the first 3-4 months, but not 2 years later. This is 2 years. There's no emergency that requires changing the social contract.
Right.
Well, even with the emergency aspect of it, I mean, the emergency use authorization came from, you know, the Food and Drug Administration, and there's a statute that governs that statute, 21 USC, I believe it's section 360 BBB3. It explicitly states that anyone to whom the product is administered must be informed of the option to accept or to refuse it, as well as the alternative to the product and the risk and benefits of receiving such product. So even in the statute itself, it does give the individuals options, and it demands that whoever is administering such product, they should inform of the option to accept or refuse, and then also speak about the risk and the benefit of receiving such product. So from my standpoint, they are even violating that statute, and I don't know how they are able to get away with that. So can you expand on that,
yeah.
Mr. Bay? Can you expand on that, Kevin?
No, I agree. I agree with everything you said. That's how they're getting away with it. And I think all of the legal cases, and I'm on some threads with a lot of lawyers nationwide, and I think every one of the cases that gets filed going forward, there'll be some aspect of challenging whether there's an emergency or not that justifies any of this.
Right. That's beautiful.
Right.
So let me make this point. So this is a caller-driven show, and if anyone would like to make a comment or ask a question, please get in, press number one so you can get into the host queue, because I know there may be some people with questions for Mr. Berry or Attorney McIndoe. Because as you all were both saying, it reminded me of the Fifth Circuit's opinion, and they even questioned, like, how long is this emergency last? You know, it's kind of like you can't with the OSHA and, you know, this trying to push that through with the the statute from OSHA for the employees. Under the OSHA regulations, the Fifth Circuit is definitely questioning, like, the length of time of this emergency, so that's beautiful. I wanted to go ahead and go into religious exemptions and, you know, these mandates when we're looking at employees, we're seeing it with students. Can you all talk to us about what is the constitutional protection regarding free exercise and the right to practice your religion that we're looking at? And either one of you want to talk about that and, you know, just go into the exemptions and any experiences that we're seeing. I see them being pretty successful in a lot of places when we're looking at employees. So, what's that landscape looking like legally?
Do you want to start, Joseph, and then I'll pick up?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, with the First Amendment, which covers the free exercise of religion, we have been very successful with that in the state of New Jersey. I can speak for New Jersey because I'm barred in New Jersey. And that has been our fight to maintain the current law on the books that does recognize and respect the free exercise of religion, where a parent can essentially enunciate this right as a justification to prevent his or her child from being vaccinated. I mean, from a religious standpoint, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam have taken the position that we will not accept their vaccine.
Right.
And then that is our mandate. This is coming from our spiritual and religious leader who have made that posture, that decision, and we are following it. And then this is... It goes even beyond that statement that the Honorable Mr. Louis Farrakhan made on July 4th of 2020, last year on the 90th anniversary of the existence of the Nation of Islam. When back in 1950s, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad did make that declaration that we would not, entertain their vaccine. And this is, as a religious organization, we do have that right,
yeah.
And we have that protection under the First Amendment. And unfortunately,
okay.
We see that there has been a constant attempt to derail that First Amendment right. And I understand, what they are trying to do. The state does have the police power to pass laws,
yeah,
to protect the and general welfare of the public. That's
right.
That's in the Constitution. They do have
right. Yeah, because I think it's all new ground, Brother Joseph, and we're going to have to see it litigated. Is what I think as well.
Exactly.
We're talking about a law from way back in the 1900s. So, they're going to have to this is something that still is open, and the litigation, we retain the right to maintain our religious freedoms and our religious exemptions.
Precisely.
And so that's just that.
Precisely.
Precisely. Yes, sir.
The law, in 1905, as you alluded to, there was a Supreme Court rule in Jacobson versus Massachusetts, and it indicates that state laws or state local health authorities could compel adults to receive smallpox vaccine. And, of course, that was due to a case that was presented by Mr. Jacobson, who refused to be vaccinated, you know, with the smallpox. And and the city of Cambridge mandated that, that he will, you know, that would, he would be vaccinated. And he was fined for $5 for refusing to do so. And
you say $5?
And the court, $5 back in 1905.
Yeah,
so it would have been maybe value at maybe $500. Who knows today, today's money.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, Justice John Marshall Holland concluded that states under their general police powers had the ability to enact vaccine laws to protect citizens, you know, with the police powers, as I indicated earlier. And there was another case also that came up in 1922 in Zuch versus King, which took similar posture. But, you know, we can talk about recent cases, but I just wanted to just touch upon on the notion that regardless of those laws of state powers, state power should not be used to preempt or to interfere with federal First Amendment constitutional right to freedom of religion.
Okay.
That's right.
Yes, sir. Go ahead, Mr. Baird.
And as Joseph correctly gave a good overview of Jacobson, but the Jacobson case also was not a religion case at all. Jacobson didn't bring up a religious objection to his vaccine. So anything that would come in later would have a First Amendment protection that Jacobson did not assert.
Oh, yes, sir.
Exactly.
Okay.
And
yes,
also Dutch versus King did not bring religion as well, freedom of religion.
Right.
So that's what we're talking about tonight with this religious freedom, one of the First Amendment protections. So, Mr. Berry, as well, can you discuss it for us as well? We appreciate any insight.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Because this is one of the things that before I went to law school, I studied history as my undergraduate degree. So this is one of the things that frustrates me the most about this issue is religious freedom works really well. You know, that's perhaps like the thing that America around its founding was like best known for as like pioneering is that this concept of a agree to disagree on religion. And, you know, looking back at obviously the settlers here, they were coming from a Western European mindset, but they, in the 1600s and early 1700s, Europe had nothing but destructive wars over was the king Catholic or the king Protestant. So much blood and treasure was spilled over that foolishness, in my view, foolishness, and that the people who were starting this country and saying we want to do things differently, the first thing they did, the first thing in the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights, and then they had those five freedoms, the first one, freedom of religion, the first thing. And it's worked really well for 260 years or 70 years. And now, for the first time that I've noticed, there are, like, religious inquisitions happening in the United States by your employer or your university. That's ridiculous. It's absurd that people are having to do that. And one of the ways I've been very successful, and Joseph has also been successful at getting the students back into school, like who are being persecuted and stigmatized for this, is that every university has glowing non-discrimination and policies in their student handbook, how they don't discriminate on race, color, gender, and that's all good. That's fantastic. But then they almost need to be reminded that I think they've taken this religious freedom thing, they've taken for granted for so long they kind of forgot that they're discriminating against religion. You know, and it's my job and Joseph's job to remind them. It's like, you have a policy against discriminating against religion, and but this isn't this what you're doing? And then they don't tell us why it's approved, but then our students come back and have theirs approved. And one thing I want to say that I took down in a note at the beginning of this, from what you were saying, I think Nation of Islam deserves special recognition for how brave they have been and courageous about speaking out on behalf of their people on this subject. Because the vaccination subject is controversial. It's controversial. I've spoken to religious leaders of just about every other faith and say, can more of you come out? Can more priests come out? More ministers come out? More rabbis come out? No one has done that better than Nation of Islam. So Nation of Islam deserves special credit for that.
Yes, sir. All praise is due to Allah. And the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, as Brother Joseph said, you know, he told us, and that is what we, you know, we follow. And he's always stood on the forefront. And so we thank him, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, for his leadership. And so I'm going to go ahead and take a question. We have a question from Brother Louis. Brother Louis, assalamu alaikum.
Waalaikum salam, sister family and the guests. How are you doing tonight?
We are fine. Thank you, very Brother
well.
Louis.
How are you, brother?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So, Brother Louis, did you have a question or a comment?
Yes, ma'am. Just one quick comment to what you just said, to what I just heard about the religious leaders. And I think that one of the reasons why we in the Nation of Islam, under the leadership of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, stand at the forefront and caring and helping our people to understand what's going on, and not the other religious leaders, because the other religious leaders are in the hands and the pockets of the government that's pushing this, are those who are pushing these mandates. We've got churches out here who are giving shots. We've got churches out here and pastors who are encouraging their parishioners to get vaccinated and even to get the boosters. And I'm not talking about the little pastors. I'm talking about pastors of mega churches. And so I think that's the difference that you see. We don't have our hands. The Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan doesn't have his hand in his pockets, into the pockets of the government. So that's why we're able to be free to warn our people. So I just wanted to say that. Now, my question is, I spoke with Sister Pamela early today, and I'm going to make my question real short. I gave her the long version. I am a field interviewer for a research firm that's nationwide. We have this research firm is contracted to the NIH and the FDA. After June, we were told we could go into the field as long as we had our protocols correct, meaning we had to wear our mask and we had to wear gloves. We could go face-to-face and do the interviews. Then about 2 months ago, when the mandate came out, they said, okay, they pulled everybody out the field and said, you can only go in the field if you're vaccinated. Those of us who weren't vaccinated, we could only make telephone calls. And then they came back and said, well, you can't be a field interviewer at all now with this mandate unless you get an exemption. So many of us got the exemption for religious purposes, both Muslims and Christians got the exemption. We started training. They stopped us in training and said, well, only thing you can do, you can't go out in the field, you can make telephone calls. So the question is, isn't that discrimination? Because if we have been given an exemption, why are we now being discriminated against that we cannot fully participate as field interviewers by going face-to-face as well as phone calls, and we can only do now phone calls, when it's evidence that anyone who has been vaccinated can still be affected by the coronavirus. So that's my question. Legally, is that an issue we could take to EEOC and maybe a law firm or something of that nature can take it from there? That's my question.
Yeah, and Brother Lewis, I think you're a federal contractor, right? Isn't that the
federal contractor?
Okay.
I think this company I'm with has well over 500 employees under these contracts.
Okay, yes, sir. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
That's an excellent question, and I agree that is clear discrimination, and that's the kind of case that I think will be similar to what I was mentioning earlier when we were reopening New York State. They're not, for all the reasons the caller mentioned, they're not going to be able to justify it. If you get the vaccine, you can still get it and spread it. Whatever interview they're doing in the field, why can't you stay 6 feet apart? It's not like you're slow dancing with the people you're interviewing, right? So all of these things that people have been doing for the last year and a half, that's where you start, like, the reasonable accommodation process. It is when you apply for a religious exemption, your employer is supposed to, if they approve it, they have to provide you with a quote-unquote reasonable accommodation that does not cause a, quote, undue hardship to them. So to the caller's employer, I don't see where there's any undue hardship for him to be able to go out in the field and do the same job as everyone else. The few types of jobs that would have a legitimate argument about allowing people in for undue hardships would be like ICU units for the hospital or nursing homes with a lot of senior citizens with comorbid conditions. So that's about it. There aren't that many other types of employers who, if they allow people to freely practice their religion, would be facing an undue hardship.
Great. Thank you for that. All right, Brother Lewis, thank you so much for calling. Yes, sir.
Thank you,
Brother. I might have took him off. I'm sorry. But if anyone else has a question or a comment, please press the number one. You can get in the host queue. And so I think going back to a point you raised earlier, Mr. Berry, this freedom also regarding the right to exercise your religion, you know, for me as a person, it also looks at my religion is that I want safety. I want my body autonomy. I don't want to be an experiment. And so I saw that you did a book, and in that book, some of the research and data from autism, the whistleblower with the CDC, and I wanted to ask you, was there any data which reflects a disproportionate amount of black children being impacted by these shots and what was going on? Because we have this long history of what we would like to call genocide, where, you know, going back to Brother, I know you brought it up, Brother Joseph, about Tuskegee, and, you know, but even before then, we don't trust, you know, we know that we've been the victims of murder and other mistreatment. So I was just wondering what the autism data, could you discuss that at all?
Yes, that is the data that was hidden, that was the subject of my book and the subject later of the film Vaxxed. But what the CDC found in a study that was published in 2004, when they were trying to ascertain whether there was a problem between autism and vaccination. And they had two separate focuses. They were looking at thimerosal or mercury in vaccines, and they were looking at the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, rubella, because parents were reporting that vaccines with mercury and vaccines with MMR, the MMR vaccine were causing autism in children. So the data that they found, they did studies in various cities. They did, and one of the cities was Atlanta, and Atlanta has a disproportionately African-American population. But one of the things they found in Atlanta was that boys, African-American males, who got the vaccine, the MMR vaccine on time, meaning two doses before age three, had a 3.4 times higher rate of autism than any other category than white males, white or black females. And so that's the signal that research found. And in order, that was not what they were expecting to find. But if you're doing honest research, you just publish your results. Instead, the way that they had to, they found a way to change the data. And the way they changed the data to make that signal go away is they put in a requirement that all the people who were in that study had to have been born in Georgia and have a Georgia birth certificate. So that threw out enough of the African-American boys to disguise the signal.
Mm.
Now that is dirty. That is dirty as can be. That's affecting every child, white, black, boy, girl, all across the country. And that was suppressed almost 20 years ago. So the data was thrown in the garbage in 2002 and published in 2004. And that was used, those studies were used as an excuse to say, there's no connection between autism and vaccines. And
wow.
So many other layers of the dirtiness of that is they only looked at two things, mercury and the guy who wrote the paper, William Thompson, was recorded by Brian Hooker as saying that he would never give a shot with mercury to his own pregnant wife because of the concerns. And they also looked at MMR, and the MMR vaccine had that signal that they erased. What they should have done, if they'd been honest, would say, hey, we have this signal. We don't know if it's true. But everybody hold off on MMR while we do studies in 10 other cities and see if there's something here.
Mm-hmm.
But rather than do that, they just put everyone else at risk forever.
Wow. Wow, that's interesting. Yeah, thank you so much for bringing that to light. I know our minister in California, Minister Abdul Malik, has also been involved with that study and sounding the alarm. So we just thank you all for being on the front line with this, because one of the issues, go ahead,
yeah,
Brother Joseph.
I was going to say that this is consistent with the history of, as you mentioned before, the Tuskegee experiment that began in 1932. And at the time that there was no known treatment for syphilis, which we know is a contagious venereal disease, and they used 600 African American men in Macon County in Alabama to be enrolled in that study, and those individuals a number of them were infected with the virus. And even after they were able to, you know, to discover about 12 or 13 years later, they discovered the penicillin, you know, a cure for that disease, they still kept those individuals without, you know, the medication that would heal them or cure that condition. And this is the reason why the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan has taken the position that you cannot trust this government at all, because we have the history to substantiate our position, and it's based on facts. And now, coupled with the Dr. William Thompson's blowing the whistle on himself. And on the CDC, when he clearly stated that there were data that were omitted to cover up any undesirable outcome in order to reach a predetermined result. And that in itself constituted a research fraud. They were engaging in actual research fraud. And so I think... Kevin, for having, you know, showcased that in his book, because to me and to us in the Nation of Islam, these are ammunition that we can use to justify our position, that we're not going to just bring our arm to this government and be vaccinated under no circumstance, especially after our leader and teacher, the Honorable Mr. Lois Farrakhan, has given us specific directive to take that vaccine. We can't trust this government in doing so. And, of course, the minister indicated that there are 14 protocols out there that may be considered in order to address the need to eradicate COVID, the virus itself. But to just openly accept this vaccine from this government without having our own scientists to study it and determine viability and efficacy of this vaccine, it would be negligent on our part and even suicidal based on their history. So, again, I want to thank you, Kevin, for bringing those points to the forefront. These are war points for us.
Right. Great. We got a caller. I think we have another caller. Let me go ahead and open up her mic. Let's see. Caller. Yes. Lavette, you have a question or a comment?
Well, I have both.
How are you, ma'am?
I'm doing well. Actually, thank you so much, Sister Pam, and your guests for bringing up this, I guess, challenging point about these vaccines and the things that are really affecting our communities. I really wanted to make a comment on what Brother
Thank
Lewis.
Thank you for calling, sis.
You're more than welcome. Brother Lewis, when he spoke about how, you know, us being a nation of Islam and how we have our firm stance on no vaccinations whatsoever because of the, you know, medical apartheid of this history, and how most churches, and I can bear witness to what he's saying, are definitely in the pocket of the government. So you see these leaders that are, like he said, having, you know, they're really speaking about getting vaccinated and they're really promoting it, and which is really, you know, mind-boggling in this time. And also, I was reading the information about New York, had a question about that, how New York City is expanding the COVID vaccine mandate for children starting as young as 5 years old, and mandating people in the private sector to make sure that they get vaccinated in order to keep their jobs. And being a teacher, I know that educators also, you know, have been, there's a lot of pressure on teachers to make sure that they get vaccinated, and they're being threatened with their jobs. Just kind of wanted to, you know, get a perspective of your panel. And one last thing, I've heard some states are actually allowing, the schools are allowing the mobile clinics to come to the school and vaccinate the children without the parents' consent, Historically, I remember as a little girl this going on in our communities, and I think it's something that's being repetitive starting all over again, where, you know, the pressure is on where parents don't even have a say-so about their children being vaccinated. And I wanted to get, you know, you and your panel's perspective on that particular point.
Oh, thank you so much, beloved. Yes, ma'am.
You're welcome.
Those are all great questions, and I know every one of those issues is in front of a judge right now. I was just talking Children's Health Defense, which is Bobby Kennedy's group, and they have a team of attorneys who work there, Mary Holland and Ralph Hazelhurst, among others. And I was at a conference with them over the weekend in Nashville, Tennessee, and that was one of the subjects that came up. Washington, D.C. had one of those first statutes where they were allowing minors to give consent without parental authority. And I think they're going to be successful in challenging that case. And there's so many common sense. I have three children, so, you know, I understand the parental perspective. But if your young child can make a decision like that could affect their long-term health, their life, their ability potentially in the future to have children, and that mom and dad don't know that the kid got a vaccine, then how, if there's an adverse reaction or the kid's acting strangely the next day, how is a parent supposed to assess that if they don't know what happened, if they don't know to be on the lookout for an adverse reaction because a fifth grader went and made a decision and went to CVS? That's ridiculous. Right. That should be considered ridiculous. And I think judges will step in and see how ridiculous that is, and that, that the governments are just I think the commerce, the money here has distorted everything. But the pharmaceutical companies are just looking to open up another market. The younger they can move it down, the more money comes in. It's not that – I don't know if it's that more much more complicated than that. I don't think they care about whether they harm or whether someone gets health or bad, poor health or good health. They just want the money. And I think, though, that fits into what is affecting, and I think both of your callers mentioned the mega churches and other faiths. They're making a business decision too, unfortunately. They're not making a faith-based decision when they're not standing up to this. Mm-hmm. I think they're thinking that maybe the majority of people, let's say 60% of people want to get the vaccine and 40% don't. So they're like catering to the 60%, so more people will come to their church than not. And that is not a faith-based decision. That's a business decision.
Yeah, no, you're right. Very good point. Brother Joseph, did you want to also make a comment on that issue?
Yeah, I did see that bill when it was introduced a few years ago, actually last year in Washington, D.C., and I was appalled to see that. I mean, this has been a long time coming. The government has been trying the best to disconnect the children from the parents in so many ways. You know, and discipline your children. Meanwhile, police brutality is going rampant without proper punishment. And but if we want to go deeper than that in our discussion, we cannot ignore the fact that there has been a U.S. Policy since December 10th of 1974 when it was introduced and declassified on December 31st, 1980, the National Security Study Memorandum 200, in which it stated that it was the policy of the U.S. government to call 2 to 3 billion people, and you know, in order to protect the resources and whatnot. What business is it of any government to seek to call to diminish the number of population of its own country, of its own state, of its own citizenry? And other people throughout the world, what gives them that right, as the Honorable Mr. Louis Farrakhan raised the question? This government is acting in the place of God. Their aim is really to supplant God and to be a rebel to God's law, which is life. And this has to be exposed. And so that memorandum 200, the NSSM 200, from my standpoint, has been the guiding principle of this government, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. And it would not be surprising to me that this ongoing effort to derail our constitutional rights in order to mandate vaccines is also part of this policy as well.
Yeah, excellent. And you know, I have to say, because I am a child advocate, And so the constitutional right to family that is found, I think, under the First Amendment, I think it's so shocking that anyone could believe, any government could believe they could come between the rights of a child and their parent and usurp the parents' rights, God-given rights to their children. It just reminds you of slavery. It reminds, you know, of just a and that's why I like one of your posture, Mr. Berry, in the sense of saying we are fighting against infringement on rights. You know, black people, we were brought here as chattel slavery, so we are at a point now where we're seeing that this government is just not going to do right because we're at this juncture now where, as Brother Joseph said, you know, the population, depopulation agenda is at a height and with these shots. So, you know, but the, you know, the rights of a parent to their child is just, this is just major, major horrific infringement that they're trying to do. And especially with the issue about whether or not they're even safe. I mean, and not even that whether they're safe, they're not safe. You know, you've got, and we thank Mr. Kennedy for the Children's Health Defense information as well, because they help, as well as the Final Call. And I want to make sure that we know that the Final Call newspaper and our sister, Dr. Ava Muhammad, is over the COVID section in the Final Call, which every week puts out articles and information as to the deadly reactions and adverse reactions and some of the true science that is showing that. So, you know, this is just appalling. But yes,
let me tell one quick story that I think illustrates a lot of the problems with this, including media censorship. So my book came out in 2015. In 2016, I went to both political conventions, both national conventions, when Hillary Clinton was nominated in Philadelphia and when Donald Trump was nominated in Cleveland. And I went there with a simple question that you just posed. I said, if there's a conflict, decision-wise, between the parents and the state on how to vaccinate a child, who decides, the parent or the state? So at the Republican convention, it was about 75% of the people there were answering that with the parent. So that made me somewhat comfortable, but I was concerned about the 25%. At the Democratic convention, it was very frightening as someone who was formerly a registered Democrat. Literally 100% of the people were saying the state decides, that the state knows better than the parents. And that is a very, very concerning mindset. It's a worldview. It's that parents are stupid. It's that somehow panels of people with metal degrees and lab coats and stethoscopes know better than mom and dad, and that's just not true. It's not true.
That's what we are concerned about the posture of the Supreme Court. There's only, as far as educational issue is concerned, the U.S. Supreme Court has only addressed that one case from Indiana, I believe, where it was brought up on an emergency basis, and then the Supreme Court, only one judge actually indicated that, you know, they would not go against the they would not honor the injunction raised by those 8 Indiana students. So we have not had a case yet, and we are waiting to see when such is going to happen, where the U.S. Supreme Court will demonstrate its posture toward the mandatory vaccine, particularly where education cases are concerned. So when I heard Kevin mention that story, it brought to mind that, you know, those justices, most of them, from my studies, we see that they have significant political careers. before they get on the bench. A lot of them have not necessarily came through, you know, the rigor of being a judge from Superior Court and Federal Court and then Supreme Court. Most of them from my studies have come from political careers, and so it is almost expected when they are rendering decisions, you could see that there is a tendency to fall consistently into liberal and conservative patterns on a wide array of issues. But naturally, you know, they're not going to say, well, because I'm a Republican, I vote this way, or because I'm a Democrat, I'm going to vote this way. No, they oftentimes, you know, would use legal language or develop legal philosophies to support political views they hold on independent grounds. So, you know, we have to watch that, but we want to test the Supreme Court with some of those cases, and so far we haven't really had one that has come full-fledged, except for that one that came on an emergency basis where educational-related cases is concerned. Kevin, I don't know if you want to expound on that.
No, I think that's right. Usually the judicial process does move pretty slowly, but I think in this case things are going relatively quickly. The Supreme Court's term ends in June. I think we'll know we'll have a decision from them on the Biden mandates, which I think I'm relatively confident they're going to get struck down, because the federal government does not have authority to do this. These are agencies within the federal government. There's three different types of federal mandates. One's coming from OSHA. That's for the general government contractors. That's the companies that are 100 or more. One's coming from CMS, which is the Medicaid, Medicare people. And that's for healthcare workers, and that's where they're threatening the healthcare employers that if they don't make the employees get vaccinated, then they can't get reimbursed from Medicare, Medicaid, which you know would sink the healthcare enterprise. And the other is just from President Biden as the direct boss of federal employees and the military. So there's three different types of mandates that are coming out of Biden. They're all unprecedented. I think they're all unconstitutional, and they're all based on an emergency, which isn't real. I should say isn't real. I don't mean to say that there's no such thing as COVID or that there are not people who have passed away from it, but it's not real. It's not an emergency to the extent that we have to totally redo how we run the country.
Right, yeah. And that's one thing about this show. You know, we're lawyers, so there's a legal standard, like there's a definition, what is emergency mean, and it's just not meeting that particular standard, and that's what I think. Because as lawyers, one thing, and we're coming down to the last on this show, but, you know, we know that experts, and sometimes the lay people don't know that experts will say what they're paid to say, and it's not necessarily true that what their pontification or what their opinions are. And then I just wanted to say, too, when you talked about the lawsuit filed by the lady with Children's Health Defense against the D.C. Consent statute, can you tell us a bit about that? Because I do love the fact that when people are challenging these cases, they are backing down because they can't justify these unconstitutional acts. It kind of reminds me of resist the devil and he will flee you. So I think it's heartening to our listeners to know that people are standing up and they're winning, you know, some of this pushback on these mandates. And so could you spend a little time with that, what you may know about that case?
I can, but I'm not an expert on it, but I know a little bit about it. But I'll tell you what I know. It's called, there's a concept called the mature minor doctrine, which should, like, that's a little – doesn't make sense. You've already lost me. right? You know, but
right.
The concept is, you know, for things like birth control. If you're from an extremely traditional family, and you're found with birth control, and if your parents found out, they would do something drastically harmful to you. It's that kind of concept, or that if you were gay and if they found out, right? So it's the same kind of concept, is that if your parents are crazy anti-vaxxers, but you know better because you watched a 30-second commercial during Sesame Street and Dr. Fauci and Elmo told you to get a shot.
Right.
You know, it's that concept that you need to, sometimes you need to protect the children from the parents. That's the concept. And why it's important, and I think Children's Health Defense makes, you know, wise decisions with, you know, they have resources on this side of the community that most other places don't, but they have nothing compared to pharma or the federal government. So that they're bringing this case in D.C. will get it noticed by the right people in Congress. So I think that's important. And as you mentioned appropriately, most judges went to law school. They didn't go to medical school. So they're kind of hardwired to defer to quote unquote experts. And if you're an expert in 2021 at the state level, county level, federal level, you didn't get there by thinking out of the box. You got there by, right. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Yes, of course. Yes. Yes. We do what pharma tells us to do. Yes. We don't rock the boat, right? We don't advance alternative ideas. That's not who those people are. And so I think the judges are starting to wake up to that. They're starting to see it because, you know, as Joseph mentioned, I think there is a level of corruption, you know, when you get to the judge level. And I remember in law school, one of my professors said, don't be intimidated by judges. They're just lawyers who know a senator. which I always remember. And but the judges, the safe thing for judges to do is just agree with what the public health experts say. That's the safe thing to do, right? Mm. But what we're seeing now, and again, this is where I think the Omicron, whatever they're calling the latest thing,
right?
Where the judges are starting to say this is bullshit. You know, why are we continuing to do this? And I do, like you mentioned, the Fifth Circuit earlier. There were some harsh words in what the Fifth Circuit wrote. It said that Biden's mandate is stunningly overbroad, and that's exactly right. But you rarely see judges put words like opinion words like that in their opinions. So, and again, one simple thing, because I have a lot of healthcare workers in New York. Most people don't understand that half of the people who work in healthcare never see patients. Half of the people who work for quote unquote healthcare work in marketing, billing, scheduling. They're not everyone in healthcare is in the operating room. So when you pass something, everyone in healthcare has to behave in a certain way, especially about something like religion, which requires the highest level of judicial scrutiny. You need to have a compelling state interest, and you need to narrowly tailor that interest to the problem. It's clearly not narrowly tailored. Everyone who works in healthcare has to do the same thing. Everyone in the military has to do the same thing. Similar concept in the military, because I have some military clients as well. Like, there are certain aspects of the military, like Navy SEALs or like the quick strike force, people like who have to like muster in half an hour and get on a plane and go somewhere. Like, if you have that type of military job, there can be an argument that it would be an undue hardship that you can't have some kind of outbreak of anything for those people because of the specifics of their job. But that's a small fraction of the military. But you're going to have a policy that tries to take care of millions of military employees that actually impacts 5,000 of them. So it's not narrowly tailored. It's not commensurate to the problem. It's much larger to the problem. And coincidentally, it sends a lot of money to pharma.
Yes.
Dr. Schubel said that the pharmaceutical company is the fourth branch of the government. I don't know if you catch that. So because, you know, with their lobby power, you know, they are able to influence laws and whatnot, even if the law may not necessarily be based on true hard science. You know, they just, you know, paying individual to ghostwrite certain things to make it acceptable, like Dr. William Thompson had to do before he blew the whistle on himself. He wrote that, you know, there was no connection, you know, between the autism and the MMR vaccine. So can you imagine a number of scientists like that coming before a judge and present their position based on skewed studies that have had many omissions, and then the judge, because the judge is looking at an expert that does not have any other expert who would dare challenge that expert, then, you know, that becomes judicial notice. You know, we accept this as fact.
Right.
So it's unfortunate we have this issue. And then, Kevin, you mentioned earlier mature minor doctrine. You know, and I giggle when I heard that, because as a lawyer, you, of course, we like words. And I started thinking about, you know, maybe those judges, you know, have to take into account there is such a thing as immature adult doctrine too.
Sad and kills your child. Let me take this caller, because we are down to our last several minutes. Would you all mind me taking this call? Let me take this call.
Come get your children.
202. Is 202? Yes. I'm sorry. I opened up the mic. Are you question or comment?
I'm glad she didn't just want to kill the children.
Okay. I don't know if they're actually wanting to be on. So, you know what, and going back to you all's conversation about pharmaceuticals, and so it really comes down to this no liability and how this vaccine injury acts, and then, the, you know, prior to that, it was already very limited. But how troubling is any type of injury potentially, or where there's no liability? There's no liability, or very minimal, you know, somewhere in some obscure office, somewhere there's something. Is this unprecedented to see that if people are injured, there's nothing that they really can do? Just talking about liability.
Well, yes. Well, that's what got me into this. My son, I have a son who's on the autism spectrum from a vaccine injury. He's going to be 24 at the end of this month. You know, just seeing how false they have been, meaning the public health people, from the beginning on this, like that helped prepare me for this time, where I've seen for 20 years how they couldn't tell the truth if they tried. And they don't have to. They have no consequences. There's no consequences for them being wrong. And if you want a simple way to view the vaccines, the reason that vaccines have liability protection is they're unavoidably unsafe. You can't make a safe vaccine. So that's why they have liability protection. And that's the Bruchowitz case. That's 2011 Supreme Court.
Right,
but they're marketed as safe and effective. So, again, the simplest way to look at it: when the money's coming to the pharmaceutical company, it's safe and effective. If you're injured by it and want to be compensated for your lifetime injury, it's, did we say safe and effective? We meant unavoidably unsafe.
That's right.
And if you think about it, of course it's unsafe, right? How do you take a bacteria, a virus, run it through organs of another species, throw in some preservatives, mix it up in a soup, and ship it all around the world? How do you do that safely? And so some other things that are unavoidably unsafe are race cars and chainsaws. Like, you can't go to the chainsaw company and say, I lost a finger to a chainsaw. They say, it's a chainsaw. You know, how do you make it a safe chainsaw? Or you got in a race car and you hit the wall at 200 miles an hour, you can't sue the race car manufacturer because it's a race car.
Right.
And it's the same thing with vaccines. And people don't perceive it that way, but you can't sue the vaccine manufacturer because they say, yeah, it's a vaccine, it's dangerous.
Right.
You know, yeah, it's a chainsaw. Yeah, it's a chainsaw. Chainsaw, you're gonna get, it can hurt you, right? So the only question is what percentage, like what no one really argues that whether vaccines can injure or kill. They can. That's not debatable.
Right.
It's just what's the size of that problem. And to me, I saw a good meme the other day. It just said, you know, if they don't get the vaccine, that they're 100% protected from vaccine injury from the COVID shot, and they're 99.998% protected from COVID by natural immunity, and they'll take that deal. That's where I think people are generally smart, I think that the government needs to start viewing things like that more. Of course, are there bad parents who are not dutiful to their children? I think yes, but a very small number. Most of them across every faith are loving parents who will do anything for their kids.
That's right. Yes, sir. Yeah, so that's wonderful. Like you say, the false, to me, it's false advertising, it's deceptive, and it's just really predatory what these companies are doing, these medical companies are doing, trying to force people. So we're down, and so I would like to thank Mr. Kevin Berry, Attorney Kevin Berry, for taking out your time to talk to us. And is there any closing remark you want to make on how, you know, what people should do if they want to contact you? Please, we're down to like a minute.
Sure. Sure. I can be reached. Email's the best. It's kevin@mermigislaw.com, mermigislaw.com. And you know, we're pretty busy these days, but we've been very, very high success rate helping people keep their jobs and their education. So if you need help, feel free to reach out.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you very much. And you, Brother Joseph, I would like to thank you again for, you know, reaching out and bringing on Attorney Kevin Berry. And thank you for coming on. Very insightful, very informative. I appreciate you so much, Brother Joseph. So let everyone know how they can contact you as well.
Certainly. Thank you so much. Well, it was a pleasure to have Kevin on board. He's very valuable in that fight that we are engaging in, especially on the legal front. And, you know, our goal and aim is to bring all like minds together to fight against this demonic force that seeks to call 2 to 3 billion people from our planet. In any event, my contact information is you can reach me by phone 732-240-0030, or you can reach me by email at Macandell. 12 AOL.com or Brother Macandell at gmail.com. Macandell is spelled MAKHANDAL at gmail.com. So it's been a pleasure, and thank you so much for the opportunity to share with your audience. Assalamu alaikum. Yeah.
Wa alaikum salam. And so I would like to thank you all for listening to A Time for Justice. We are a show on the Elevated Places Network. I would like to thank the Elevated Places team, Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad and the rest of the team. I'd like to also thank Sister Samaya Muhammad. And I would like to inform you all to hear previous shows. You can log into the Elevated Places and you'll find archived shows, as well as please listen to Ask Dr. Ava. That's on Thursdays at 7 p.m. Standard Time, and that is the show on the Elevated Places. That is actually the Elevated Places with Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad. And I would like to thank the listeners and the callers. Thank you once again for listening, and please tune in next week for more informative discussions. Thank you to the panelists. and assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. Peace.
Thank you.
Kevin, thank you for watching.